I'm delighted now to welcome Chris Mooney. He is a contributing editor to Science Progress and the author of The Republican War on Science, and his latest book is Unscientific America: How Scientific Illiteracy Threatens Our Future. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
It's good to be back.
So, scientific illiteracy is one of the many problems which you talk about in your book. What do you mean by scientific illiteracy?
Well, there's actually different meanings out there, and so it's a great question to start off with. When people mention scientific illiteracy, the most popular thing that's generally meant is the level that people have in terms of factual knowledge of the basics of science, and that's not very good. So when you ask Americans in polling questions to answer just factual points, how long does it take the Earth to go around the sun, what's larger, an atom or an electron, you often get only about half the public getting the answer right. So we have a fairly low level factual knowledge of the basics of science that was learned in high school or that should have been learned in high school.
There are also some problems which, as you point out, really are not about scientific illiteracy. There are some discussions in which there's a very high level of scientific understanding, but certain fundamental points are missed. What are some examples of that?
Yeah, well, you can define scientific illiteracy differently, so we define it in a broad enough way that actually it does include a lot, pretty much everything. But I think what you're getting at there is if you take something like global warming, evolution, the contentious political issues, then we go on to argue that while people are pretty ignorant of science, when you look at how these political debates play out and who's involved in them, it turns out that the people who are, you know, saying wrong things and misleading us aren't actually ignorant. That's not their problem. They're actually very well informed, but they're so well informed that they're putting out a lot of misinformation that they've worked very hard on crafting.
There's a great quotation. I don't have it in front of me, but by Mark Twain.
The trouble with the world is not that people know too little, it's that they know so many things that just aren't so.
So that's, it's a great quote. It's vintage Mark Twain, but it's also, I mean, when you get into questions of evolution and in so-called intelligent design and so on, there are a lot of things that people deeply believe that, at least as far as science can take it, are just not true.
Yeah, and not only do they deeply believe things, but they construct fairly elaborate justifications for the things that they believe, and the justifications are pretty flimsy. But there's all this, you know, information that is used to argue, and generally people don't change their mind. Rather, they fall back on different rationalizations of what they already think.
There is, in many circles, a mistrust of science and scientists, and there are some really good reasons for that and some really bad reasons for that. The good reasons are, you know, if you think about it, science gave us nuclear weapons, DDT, the introduction of non-native species to supposedly solve certain ecological problems, but instead made them worse. Even plastic bags, which are choking the environment and things like that, they all come from science. But then there's also the other side, which is just ridiculous stereotypes that you have in the entertainment industry.
Mm-hmm. True. And so we talk about how, you know, to some extent, science fell off its pedestal following World War II and the space race and all the rest because of this sort of revelation that, wow, we can destroy the environment with these products of science. We can cause human health risks. So that's very valid. But then as we go on to say, when you look at how that kind of concern translates itself into popular culture, then you really get some visions of scientists that don't do us any good. And so you get them depicted as sort of evil madmen out to destroy the world, which they most certainly are not. I mean, even if some products of science have not always been 100% beneficial, I don't think that that's really an accurate representation of the average scientist.
Somewhere in the book you talked about, I guess it was a TV show or a movie, that didn't want to cast a certain person as a scientist because they were too good-looking and normal-seeming.
I'm not sure what that is, but that's sort of the case. I mean, the scientist figure in most Hollywood dramas has to be nerdy, has to be socially dysfunctional in some way, and the stereotype is powerful enough that, you know, children don't believe, for example, when they meet a non-nerdy, young, or good-looking scientist, they find it hard to believe it's actually a scientist because the stereotypes are more real to them than the reality is.
So if that's the case, that means there's something deeply wrong in elementary school education.
Well, or at least deeply wrong in our culture and how it influences how we think.
But in other words, the education isn't counteracting that stereotype by having real scientists teaching them and getting them excited.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, in terms of the educational system, this broader cultural context in which it occurs, in which scientists are sort of oddballs, then gets reinforced by, you know, as kids sort of get into middle school and start taking real serious science classes, there's this, you know, and often the classes are, you know, hard and boring, and there's this sort of sorting effect where a lot of kids tell themselves, this is not for me, this is not what I do, this is what those geeky smart kids do, and I'm never going to be good at it.
There's a real problem, as you write about, in the disconnection between different areas, science, politics, the media, entertainment, religion, and so on. Why is science so divorced from all of these other areas? And the answer isn't obviously the same for each one.
No, and that's sort of how we build the body of the book, is looking at how science fails to get through to these areas where we really need it to get through, because they should be working together. And the answer, as we put it, is that there's a kind of a two cultures effect in each area. And what that means is you got highly talented people working in different spheres who are sort of specialized to know their sphere, but not so open to understanding a different one. And so in each case, the scientists are specialized to be very good with handling scientific information, very good at technical accuracy, very good at taking the long view of where things are going and so forth. But those attributes, while they're very valuable in science, don't match up well with the skills that are required to be a politician, a journalist, an entertainer, a religious leader, and so forth. And so you get these communication breakdowns all the time.
Let's talk about some of them in detail. For example, science and journalism. First of all, we're in kind of a big problem because the newspaper industry is in so much trouble, and a lot of science journalism very recently has been done away with. But even before that, There have been some real problems, some disconnects between scientists and journalists, between scientific writing and journalistic writing.
Absolutely. So you got to take the two issues separately, because I think that the former makes the latter worse. In other words, there were problems with how science is covered in the press that are longstanding. When you then fire science journalists, which is happening now, the problems get worse because you have less people who are likely to know how to avoid them, because you have less people who understand anything about science. But let's talk about then the basic problems that are longstanding. I mean, basically, the press is always in search of the dramatic and the new. And so this leads to a tendency to jump on any seemingly hot, novel scientific result and play it up. But in fact, anyone who covers science or follows science in detail knows that no one study is ever equivalent to truth. And in fact, many, you know, new studies are wrong and are overturned fairly quickly in the course of the scientific process. So if you leap on something, you're quite likely to be misinforming your audience. And what you really need to do is take a step back and look at the big picture of knowledge. But the media is rarely set up to do that. So that's one of the problems.
They're not set up to do it because they're doing basically daily journalism, and so they have to come up with a story that they didn't have before. Can you imagine a structure which would allow them to do more big picture journalism?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, it's still easy to make it very interesting. It's more of a feature story, long form kind of thing when you actually get to provide a bigger picture. But what I guess I'm saying, and that, so that structure already exists. What I guess I'm saying then, in terms of what kind of journalism should be done, is that there ought to be really a lot of holding off on leaping on, you know, once this study says X in the news, and much more, you know, taking a broader picture.
And then you don't get into problems like, oh, eggs are good for you. No, they're bad for you. You should take lots of vitamin C. No, you shouldn't. That kind of thing, where people just get confused and then they get dismissive of the whole set of questions.
Yeah, people get so down on science, especially as it impacts their health, because of this problem that you're talking about right there, where they feel like they can't trust the media and they can't trust science because all it gives them is contradictory information all the time. Well, that's because of this jumping on one result all the time. And it's not just the media does this, but, I mean, in fairness, you have different scientific institutions constantly putting out press releases whenever they've got a new study in a new journal. So they're feeding the beast. And you also have industry, and particularly the pharmaceutical industry, publicizing every new study, which can actually affect their stock prices if they get enough attention to them.
There's another problem, which you write about to some extent in the book Unscientific America, namely the deregulation of media that had a profound influence on the kind of journalism that was done in the first place, including but far beyond science journalism.
Exactly. You know, the state of the media today is, I think, well epitomized by a statistic that I just read, Columbia Journalism Review provided, and it was that the salary of Katie Couric, $15 million, they said, was roughly equivalent to the operating budgets of two NPR programs for a year, and the two NPR programs were Morning Edition and All Things Considered. So that sort of shows you how the media industry is working, and I think that this is a product of deregulation and basically a sort of bottom-line-driven quote journalism, which is really more focused on entertainment, making sure you keep eyeballs, and much less focused on investment in producing news and new information and having incredibly high standards. So in that context, what happens is that the science coverage, which is very substantive, takes a lot of work, takes a lot of thought, and is often seen as not being entertaining enough, not, you know, drawing enough eyeballs, that stuff gets cut, and what you get instead is infotainment, entertainment, the kind of stuff that, you know, basically makes more money.
There was also, before, there are a couple of different deregulations in the last 30 years or so, but if you look back, and not that there was ever a golden age of journalism, as we can talk about it in endless detail, but there was a requirement for some public service journalism in order for people to have, for example, their broadcast licenses.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it's just generally been a trend of cutting all of the public interest-oriented things and making the market dominant. And, you know, so what happens in that context? Well, unfortunately, science journalism has not always been able to show that it has a lot of power in the completely free market. So, I mean, that should change, I believe. I don't think that has to be the case. I think that science journalism can be entertaining and can command audiences, but it's been a real struggle to have it happen at news organizations. And if you just look at cable news, for example, we provide a figure that just 1 minute out of 300 is devoted to science and technology-related topics on cable news. So there's a clear decision there that this is not what we do. And I appeared on a cable news show actually to talk about the book Morning Joe on MSNBC, and they read this statistic, and then they laughed, and they're like, wait, is that what we do? Well, we're making up for it now, at least. So it was kind of a funny moment.
We're talking to Chris Mooney, author of Unscientific America, How Scientific Illiteracy Threatens Our Future. Another area which I think is very important to talk about in some detail is the relationship or non-relationship between science and politics and what is really going on, both in the way that these two different sets of people work, and there's also some funding. There's some money issues involved as well.
Yeah, well, again, you got very different groups of people and sort of like ships passing in the night, not quite understanding each other. You've got the scientists who try to be super dispassionate and do, on the one hand, on the other hand, testimony to Congress and, you know, refuse to take a stance and often refuse to not only take a position politically, but refuse to shape the basic core scientific information so that you can see how it can lead to a particular policy option versus another one. Scientists aren't well trained to do that. Meanwhile, politicians are, you know, frustrated, don't have a lot of time to listen to all of the scientific nuances. They want an answer, they need an answer that's not relevant necessarily to the whole, you know, country, the whole globe, but their particular constituency at a given time. So you got groups of people that are, you know, operating very, very differently. And what we need are people who are skilled at being bridge builders.
You also have another problem, which is in arguably the most important area where science should affect politics, namely climate change and energy policy. There is a whole lot of money put into both so-called science and the PR machine by the fossil fuel industries, who are also paying for politicians by contributing to their campaigns to create a false, I mean, it's a little bit better now than it was a few years ago, but this false sense of balance. On the one hand, climate change is real. On the other hand, no, it's not.
Yeah, and the media goes along with that, too. Basically, this is the problem of science in Washington. You got, on the one hand, the scientists themselves are not really skilled at making what they know relevant to the people making the decisions. Meanwhile, the special interests, in this case the fossil fuel industry, are working, you know, nonstop and doing a very good job of making their view of things very salient to people in politics, and they're spending a ton of money on it. And so you get the average legislator or the average legislator's staff bombarded with all of this information from, you know, politicized, quote, media outlets, from think tanks, from lobbyists, and they don't have a scientific filter. They don't know how to sort through it, and the scientists are continuing at a communication disadvantage, which is partly of their own doing, because they don't really invest in how to reach the political system either. So no wonder they lose so often on so many of these issues.
There's another strain that runs through American life and American political life and journalistic life, which is anti-intellectualism, which has been written about eloquently for the last 50 years. What is that all about? Where does it come from in our soul, our American soul?
Yeah, well, the argument of the historian Richard Hofstadter, who wrote most famously about this in, I think, 1964, was that it's part of the unique composition of the American people, and then it goes back to our very founding, and it has to do with our strong religiosity on the one hand, and our strong sort of celebration of business and industry and innovation, which is an impulse that gives us, you know, we're not very tolerant of just, you know, thinking for thinking's sake. We're only tolerant of thinking that leads to technology and productivity and growth and all the rest. So someone is sort of idly contemplating and just using their minds for no apparent reason, then Americans sort of say, sneer and say, oh, what a waste.
There's so many really good answers to that don't seem to get a lot of airtime.
Well, no, I mean, because it's sort of a deep set reaction. And the good news is that we're kind of a paradoxical people, and we sometimes lean very heavily towards science anyway, and then we lean back again. So there have been some moments in U.S. history, especially the founding, which was the Enlightenment, when everybody was real focused on science, and also the 50s and 60s, which was sort of when we built And World War II, when we built the scientific infrastructure that we have now, where everybody turned towards science, but then it can be easily forgotten again, and this anti-intellectual impulse is always kicking around.
Talk about Carl Sagan and his role in the scientific dialogue of the United States. On the one hand, he was really popular and actually had an effect on the Reagan administration, which the administration wasn't too happy about. On the other hand, he was kind of persecuted by other scientists for being a popularizer.
Yep. I mean, Sagan is just such a great example because you probably don't have anyone popularizing science in the second half of the 20th century who is more visible and more influential than he was. And what you mentioned about the Reagan administration is the most dramatic example because he took them on in a very prominent way over the Star Wars program and nuclear weapons generally. And they had to answer, and Sagan was someone feared and dreaded, I think, by the Reagan White House. And it's hard to think of a scientist today that has quite that kind of stature. But at the same time, the scientific community, its values and its alignment are such that a lot of people in science didn't see what was so great about Sagan, because Sagan, he did some important scientific work, but mainly as a popularizer and a communicator, you could argue that he wasn't, you know, a top scientist in terms of producing research. And so there were a lot of judgments about him being just a popularizer, dumbing things down.
During the Bush administration, you had a real, I mean, as the title of your last book, namely The Republican War on Science, you had distinguished scientists standing up to what was going on, but because the popularization of science had really declined and there were no Carl Sagans, they weren't really listened to.
I would argue that you did have a situation, it's an interesting parallel, Sagan standing up to the Reagan administration and fighting with them over nuclear arms issues, basically, in the 80s, and scientists standing up to the Bush administration and fighting with them over global warming and other issues of scientific integrity during the 2000s. The Bush administration just brushed aside the scientists in the 2000s. Whereas if you read back over the history, it's quite clear that the Reagan administration felt very threatened by Carl Sagan. So what changed exactly? And the answer is tons of things changed. In particular, the media changed. And the influence that scientists could have changed dramatically, so that the Bush administration really wasn't too concerned about something like that, because I think that they felt that they was never going to get sustained media attention of the way that something like Abu Ghraib prison scandal would get.
You devote some time in the book to talking about the crazy portrayals of scientists on film and in television and so on. And you kind of give science fiction a bad rap. What's wrong with science fiction?
Well, I mean, there's great science fiction. Sagan did some great science fiction, you know, Contact, his movie and his novel. So I think it depends. I think there's kind of a grotesque science fiction that's done by Hollywood a lot of the time, in which you do have these stereotypes of scientists as madmen and scientists as geeks. But the science fiction genre is, you know, incredibly rich and arguably, you know, the dominant genre of entertainment in some ways.
Do you think that science fiction should really work within some levels of scientific accuracy? I mean, are people actually getting their information from science fiction?
Unfortunately, yeah, too many of us do get our information from science fiction. It's clear that fictional depictions do have a way of skewing people's sense of reality, even when they shouldn't. I think that, you know, good science fiction is not completely implausible. I think that, you know, sort of the real intrigue of science fiction is the way that it goes just a little bit beyond the way things currently are, but not in a wildly implausible way, so that you can believe that this could actually happen, and it's just sort of several, not too many steps away of where we are technologically at the moment.
We're talking to Chris Mooney, author of Unscientific America, How Scientific Illiteracy Threatens Our Future. Another part of this book, which goes, basically has roots way back in the United States, is this seeming rift between science and religion. What are the roots of that?
It's sort of the never-ending battle. Well, the roots of it go back to the scientific revolution, right? You know, the Copernicus, Galileo, and the church. And it turns out that, you know, as modern science developed itself, there were certainly a lot of tensions with religion, although the story is complicated, and it doesn't turn out to be a story of all-out warfare or anything of the kind. You know, while the church clearly did persecute Galileo, and, you know, only it took 400 years for them to reverse themselves and admit that Galileo was right, the story of most of the innovators of the scientific revolution is that they were actually very religious, pious people, and Galileo himself was. And so much of the birth of modern science was done at the hands of people who were strong religious believers. It's only really with, you know, sort of the French philosophers and the Enlightenment and then the Darwinian Revolution that you really start to get atheism being something very prominent. And after the Darwinian Revolution, there's a narrative that's created by a couple of secular scientist writers, which is the narrative of sort of eternal warfare between science and religion. And then the past gets reinterpreted as a battle between science and religion all the time, when in fact it wasn't. And so historians of science have since debunked the idea that there is a necessary conflict. But, and this is a long answer, but in the United States, the idea of conflict is still dominant and sort of with us every day and plays out constantly, especially on the evolution issue.
There is a group of people known as the New Atheists, Sam Harris, Richard Dawkins, Christopher Hitchens, Daniel Dennett. What are they doing and why are they doing it?
Well, they are promoting, broadly speaking, this idea of conflict incredibly strongly, in a stronger way than the sort of secular scientific world in the United States has done for some time. And the reason they're doing it is because it's their view, very clearly expressed, that religion and faith, especially faith for them is, you know, believing without evidence, are bad for us. Just bad, bad, bad. And, you know, there's some truth to what they say, but there's also sort of a blanket condemnation of all religions and lumping everything together. You know, so religious moderates to them are disparaged just as religious extremists are. At the same time, and that loses a lot of nuance. And so I think it becomes very problematic. At the same time, they are also, you know, constantly fomenting conflict over science and religion, and I would argue that politically just doesn't get us anywhere to have people polarized and thinking that you got to have either faith or reason, but only one or the other, not both.
Something that I rarely hear brought up is the distinction between religious faith and religious experience. I'm sitting here talking to you from the Southwest, where there are Native American pueblos all around us who have dances that are very much part of their religion. But to call it faith would really be to not look at what is actually going on. There is an experience which is very much embodied that comes through dances and other parts of ritual that are not faith-based at all. And those are rarely talked about in this kind of debate.
Well, it brings up a good point, which is that the new atheists really mostly are tilting against Christianity, even though they are, you know, so they denounce all religion. But, you know, it's unclear how they handle something like Native American dance, as you mentioned. It's really unclear to me how they handle Buddhism, you know,
right.
Which is, so it's very, should we say, I don't know, Eurocentric, actually, in its approach. But generally what's wrong with it intellectually is that it just doesn't give credit to the incredible importance of religion in people's lives through the experience and the rituals that it creates. We all know that religion goes to extremes and can lead to excess. And the problem there is a problem of ideology becoming dominant and leading people to do extreme things. But there are many ideologies, and religion is only one of them. So there's not enough nuance, I believe, to the new atheist view of the world. And it does keep us polarized and hurts our society's ability to embrace science. And, of course, I got to say that on the other side, the Christian conservatives who are always attacking science are also an incredibly huge part of the problem.
They're a huge part of the problem because they've got an agenda. What would you say their agenda is where science is concerned?
Well, their agenda is to promulgate a particular interpretation of religion, which is a scripturally literalist take on religion, which means that the Bible is literally true. And so in order to be religious for them, you have to accept certain premises that are in contradiction to modern science. So Genesis is taken to contradict evolution, for example. That would be one, the most striking one. And so they have to take a doctrinaire line on that kind of stuff, and that means they got to deny what we know.
Let's turn to what we might say is the most important part of the book, which is what is to be done. You propose all sorts of ways to build bridges between science and every other area of life.
Right. So the way we do it in the book, and we sort of, the book is not that long because it's really a polemic to raise consciousness. It's not a policy proposal, but we sort of go through these areas where there are disconnects, politics, media, entertainment, religion, and we call for people who can build bridges. But then we go into more detail looking at how scientists are trained today and find out why there aren't that many people who can build bridges. And we talk about remaking that whole structure so that there are more of them. And so that's the real proposal of the book is, it turns out we've got all these young, talented, energized people who are going into scientific fields of study all the time who want to do more, and there aren't enough positions in science for them to just be university professors, and there aren't even necessarily enough positions in industry for them to be working in research for companies. So we say, can we not get them all, well, not all of them, but get a significant proportion of them doing other things that will help bridge all these gaps? And that's the call. And so we've got to get people from science into the education system more. We've got to get them into the political arena more. We've got to get them talking to the religious communities more. And you can just sort of go down the line.
One of the examples of that bridge building is the book itself. You co-wrote it with a young marine scientist named Cheryl Kirschenbaum. Tell us about that whole process, that collaboration.
This is my first co-authored book, and hopefully there will be more. I mean, it's good to work with somebody else, not just yourself. So she covers, she wrote different parts of the book, and one that she really did the most on was the part that I told you, but she was working all over the place. But she really focused on what science education is like, because she'd been through that process of becoming a scientist, and I personally hadn't. And she really, my eyebrows were raised when she described just how bad the plight is for a young scientist today in terms of their career opportunities. Something like, I believe only 7% of PhDs under 35 can hope to get a tenure-track faculty position. So the competition is extraordinary, and I think that lends a lot of power to our argument that we've got to give other options for people who are learning science to go out and help society, because they just can't all stay within the ivory towers.
Why should people right now go to their telephone and call KSFR and make a contribution to this public radio station?
Well, because, gosh, with the state of the media right now, you know, we're struggling all the time to get the most substantive and valuable information through and to get it to still have a place in competition with the really dollar-driven infotainment, entertainment that now is, quote, the news. And so when I talk about, you know, Katie Couric having a $15 million salary while public radio is struggling, I mean, that's a problem of values in the media industry. And all we can do is support those kind of outlets like your show that are providing a much more substantive, thoughtful discussion of issues than you get in much of the mainstream press.
Chris Mooney is the author of Unscientific America: How Scientific Illiteracy Threatens Our Future.